This is the Let's Grab Coffee podcast, and I'm your host, George Khalife.
It always helps, by the way, when the person you're having on your podcast has done a lot of these already. So I spent like all of yesterday going through a lot of your YouTube shorts, Gail. So I feel like, thankfully, I know you for one, but your YouTube shorts help.
I've done a few, George.
You're like a seasoned podcaster by now. Thanks for being here. I appreciate you formally being on the podcast. This is actually, you probably might not know this, but it has been a long time in the making, meaning I've been wanting to have you on the podcast for quite some time.
Excited to be here.
Awesome. For folks who don't know you as intimately as I do in the Chicago sort of startup ecosystem, you have a quick bio, which you've thankfully laid out on LinkedIn, which I'll go through very quickly, but 10 years in VC, you're a work tech expert, mainly through your work in Vitalize Capital. So it's an early stage VC and angel fund, primarily focused on work tech. You're based in Chicago. I know you do a lot in the startup ecosystem here. You're involved in a bunch of boards. You just finished Kauffman Fellows, which we'll get into loosely. But you've been investing for quite some time, Gail. So what I actually wanted to start with is, how does one formally one day say, you know what, this is going to be a career path, especially if it's not one where you have, let's say, a massive exit? Because that's where I've seen investors, quote unquote. It's either you have like a massive exit, family passes down a chunk of money, or you join a VC first, you kind of grow through the ranks. But it's an odd career path, honestly speaking, for someone to get really seasoned in this space is not your typical day-to-day corporate Fortune 500. So what was it for you? Like, when was that day when you woke up and you're like, you know what, I'm going to be a VC in Chicago?
Well, that day never really happened. So when I left business school in 2012, I knew I wanted to be running a company. I was very much a founder. I still am a founder, but I had the opportunity back in 2012 to start Irish Angels, which is my first VC firm that I started. And I hadn't really thought about venture, but I love to build companies and I love to help other people. And I love challenging things. I love learning about a lot of stuff. So when I took a step back and really thought about that opportunity, it was an interesting fit. And I didn't have any background in it. And the gentlemen that I met who were founding board members, they were like, hey, we don't have money to pay you and we don't know how to help you, but we think you could be good at this. Do you want to try it? And I happened to have 3 months of money left, which I had gotten a scholarship at the very end of Booth, luckily.
Nice.
And that money gave me 3 months to try to figure out how to get it off the ground. And it took me 3 months to find 40 people to give me a little bit of money. And then I got my credit card out.
Wow. This was for Irish Angels?
Yeah, that was for Irish Angels. So I honestly just stumbled into the opportunity to start Irish Angels. It was not my idea, but I was in the right place at the right time. And my background was a good one to, you know, give it a go. And then I ran that for 9 years and I started Vitalize in 2017 and ran them in parallel for a few years before just going straight to Vitalize.
When people hear Irish Angels, I thought this as well. I don't think there is a heavy connection to Ireland. This is yes and no, I guess, because this is under the Notre Dame University banner, right?
Yes.
So this is
Hiding Irish. Yes.
Yes, exactly.
So all of our investors have some kind of a tie, whether they're a grad, parent, student, or faculty member of the university.
By the way, this is a very, you might know this because you were in that space. I didn't know this. As someone who came from Canada to the US 4 years ago, I realized, for number one, your alumni here are insanely strongly united. You know, there's like a force behind an alumni is interesting, not odd, but interesting. I don't think it's the same extent in Canada, let alone the investing, you know, circles that you all create here, which I find, like, I know Kellogg has it through like alumni. Well, it's Lakeshore Partners, Purple Arch. That's all through alumni. Irish Angels. Wharton has an angel group. It's much more common in the US than it is in Canada. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's an interesting observation. This was new to me when I came here, like, because these are real funds. This isn't just like a club at the university.
Yeah. I think one of the things that is a big learning of mine over the last decade is that this is a way for people to have fun. And when you think about an affinity towards something, the university makes a lot of sense. It might be a geo. So you see a lot of local angel groups that still exist. You know, I'm a member of Chicago Early. All we do are invest small amounts in Chicago companies. It might be a specific industry. You hear of former Google employees having their own group, former Uber, like there's a lot of that. And it's because people feel a connection. And actually that a connection is really, really important to keep people wanting to come back. Our time can be spent in so many different things that, I think moving forward, we will continue to see strong affinity based investing. In fact, I think we'll even see smaller groups of affinity based investing where it's, you know, it's almost like your old Tupperware parties. So if you go to somebody's house and try to sell your Tupperware, you might go to a restaurant with four or five people once a month, and that's your investment circle.
Yeah, I think that's a big part of it, is like you kind of have a team, right? Like almost an alumni base. Yep. With the general wording, right? That you can share deal flow. I can also learn from someone like Gail, who's an expert in WorkTech, and maybe I'm an expert in FinTech as an example. We can share ideas and I can get you up to speed. So I think that's cool. And I feel like for a lot of people doing it for the first time, it's a bit less intimidating. I might have no idea how to do this. So me investing alongside someone who does alleviates the pain, even though I might have money.
Yeah. And that's how a lot of people get started angel investing. And I think that's a great thing. It's how I learned, was working with a bunch of other people, because it's very likely you're not going to get into the best deals or do the best deals if you are just coming at this completely green. So having that support network and being able to leverage the expertise of the crowd is absolutely a good strategy. Another good strategy is to invest in small funds, because you get built-in diversification.
Let me ask you this. When you got involved with Irish Angels, and remind me, it was 7-8 years total?
I ran it from 2012. So I started it then. And then Caroline Gash came in 21. So 9 years.
9 years. Did you learn the trade first and then started investing yourself? Or did you invest first and learn by virtue of?
So I had never invested myself. I would consider myself not to have come from very much money. So I actually didn't even think about personally investing until 2016, when Liz, then Talati from ZipFit, came up to me and said, hey, will you put $5,000 in my company? And I thought, well, yeah, actually I will. So I wrote my first check in 2016. And I love you, Liz, but it didn't work out. And you know that, but I credit her for getting me started, because then in 2017, I did a couple of deals, and actually those deals are both doing really, really well. So I did two that year. And then 2018, I started to do a few more in 2019, and I've slowly built up a portfolio personally of about 50 companies, all small checks. So between $1 and $10,000, typically $1 or $5,000 is what I put into these deals.
Nice. Yeah, that I resonate a lot with that as well. I've only written one and only so far. Mm-hmm. Proper Angel, also a smaller check, but it's also in a friend's startup, a friend who I've known for quite some time. And it was one of those, to be honest, and I think I've either heard you or Chris Deutsch talk about this, but it's not a bad strategy to invest first, let's say, in a friend, so long as you both have the understanding that this is money you're comfortable losing and it won't sour the relationship. But yeah, it did get me kind of excited. I'm like, wow, this is one, I'm supporting a friend I actually care about, whose business I'm also fond of. Mm-hmm. But it's kind of neat. Like it gets you going.
What you said is really important. It's things you care about. It's people you care about. It's things that you like. That's what's really important with angel investing. Because, and back to why a lot of people really love these affinity-based groups, it's fun. So I think that's great that, you know, you have that lens and you want to make sure that those boxes are checked before you write the check.
Mm, interesting. Yeah, I want to come back to this. There was one thing I really wanted to touch on, which is, so you've written almost 50 checks so far. One thing I found in myself is I get really excited and then I get nervous again about it. You know, I don't know if you sort of teeter totter between the two. Like, you can get this adrenaline high from investing, and then I found myself at some points like, oh shit, is this the right thing? Is it the right asset class? The opportunity cost? Do you go back and forth even as a seasoned angel now at a VC?
I'm the wrong person to ask, George. I have...
You're the adrenaline junkie?
I have a lot of my net worth in this asset class. I mean, I invest a lot into my funds. So I take very low salary. I put a ton into the funds that we have. So nearly 2%. In terms of the angel deals that I do, my strategy is this. I figure out before a year happens how much I can responsibly deploy. And then I know that I want to invest in, I typically do, I would say about 10 deals a year. And so I take that number that I want to invest and I divide it by 10. And that helps me understand how much I can invest. So for example, what this year looks like is I expect to do all of our Vitalize Angels deals at $1,000 each, and we'll probably do 7 or 8 of them. And then I'll probably do a Chicago early deal here or there, and I'll probably do 1 or 2 other things. So I've already done my 2 other things. And I've done 1 Vitalize Angels deal, but now going forward, I know here and there I only have 1,000. So even this morning, somebody from Chicago emailed me and said, hey, I hope you can invest via Chicago early. And because I know I'm already overpaced, I told her, it's like, I would love to, let me see if I can scrape money together, but I have to really stick to that because I've already decided I can light that money on fire. And if I never get it back, my life is exactly the same. And I'm so lucky to be able to say that. But that's why I'm writing $1,000 checks. And a lot of, I mean, I have truly had this happen where other angel investors have looked at me like I was crazy because I'm writing such small checks. I don't really care. I mean, all I want is access to these deals. I will tell you, any of us would have rather had $1,000 in one of these big winners like Facebook or Uber versus being like, oh, I missed it because I was waiting until I had the perfect check size of $100,000 or $50,000 or $25,000 to invest. That's silly. You have to start. And I guarantee you, if you're in one that goes 100X or 1,000X, you're not going to care what the initial in was.
Yeah, that's part of, I think that's another very difficult thing, especially when you're doing it individually. And even though they're smaller checks, that's the one thing that I always have to fight with is the, you just invested $2,000 in a company that you loved. Mm-hmm. 3 weeks later, a new shining, you know, startup comes in and it fits exactly the mold of what you're looking for. And you're like, are you serious? You know, now you come, it's 3 weeks in and I've hit my criteria. I might not have capacity. That's hard to say no to.
Yeah,
constantly, you know, and maybe it's a good problem to have. Probably a good problem to have.
But that's, it's just like gambling, you know, and anything is good in moderation. Angel investing is good in moderation. And if you can figure out your strategy and you can stick to it and you're not going to adversely impact your life or your family's life if you never get anything back, but you have to be willing to say no, or you can sit at the blackjack table and you can keep throwing money into these deals. And after a while, you can't pay off your credit cards and you don't have your 3 to 6 month savings umbrella there because you've gone way too deep into this risky asset class. Don't do that. So that's why that upfront plan is one of the most important things any angel can do.
I hear the devil's advocate listening to this, including partly my voice, even though this is the strategy I'm trying to follow, is, well, Gail, what is $1,000 really going to do? And I hear, I'm in public markets, as you know, but I hear the same thing even in public markets. And I know that that's not a good mindset to have, that 1,000 deployed is better than 1,000 not deployed for obvious compounding reasons, for example. But when you hear that objection, like, yeah, what is $1,000 really going to do versus me waiting and deploying something more material? What is the answer to that?
But what's material to you? I mean, if I left business school with $130,000 of debt, let's say as an example, and I needed, and I had a very low salary for many years because I needed to do that to run a business.
I'm in B school. Yeah.
Right. Okay. So it takes a while to pay these things off and to start to build up some kind of savings. And, you know, you have to be very prudent. And so for me and my financial situation, a check between $1,000 and $10,000 is definitely material. So, like, I don't have millions and millions and millions of dollars, maybe yet. But when I think about my financial situation, I don't know how much cash I have in the bank, and I know how much I have in the stock market, I don't know how much I have in real estate. And then for me, angel investment is kind of my other bucket. I've just done the math myself on, I know how much money I have in these other things, and I'm pretty set on that for what my goals are, because I actually don't spend a lot of money to live. Like, I've always done this. I don't spend a lot on rent. I don't spend a lot on mortgages and stuff owned. Like, it's just a way for me to keep my living expenses really reasonable. So I'm able to put a really high percentage of my investable cash into this asset class. So to me, it's like, I don't want that just to sit there in a bank or in some kind of safe security and wait until I have a ton of money. Because then how in the world am I going to pick? I have great deal flow, and anybody can get great deal flow now because there's so many groups. So if you're in Chicago Early and you're in Vitalize Angels and you're in like a Hyde Park Angels or an Irish Angels or a Hustle Squad, and you're seeing hundreds of deals a year and you like 20% of them, what are you going to do?
I want to get into aside from your personal interest, it seems like obviously you love doing this. It's clear. The second piece is, what is the financial objective? Like, do you have a specific, I know you've talked about this. I'm not going to say the answer for the sake of this conversation. Walk me through what does that actually look like? Like, you, aside from, okay, this, it meets your vertical, it meets your stage, when you're actually deploying throughout the year, so you have 100,000, assumingly, and you're deploying it over let's say 10 checks, what financial objective are you going in with?
For my fund and my personal deals is different. So for my fund, I'm underwriting to a 30x return. The reason that I do that is because, you know, we're going to have around 30, maybe 35 deals in our fund. And I want any deal that we do to be a potential what's called fund returner, which means that that one deal can give me back every dollar that was committed to the fund. That is a key, you know, strategy that any VC is going to have. And I tell founders, you know, VCs, if you take VC money, you're going to either blow up. You're going to blow up to zero and not be anything, or going to blow up really big, because VCs, they need those 30Xs. They need the 100Xs. They need the really big returns. That's how they stay in business. It's a little different on the angel side. I actually like that. When I do personal deals, I don't have to think about a 30X. I have to think about a bunch of attributes. Do I think that this is at least a 10X in a few years? Like, I did a deal, one of the deals of 2017 I mentioned that I did. I put $10,000 in it. We invested at a very low valuation. So I won't give the exact valuation, but I'll say it was somewhere between 3 and 6 post money. And they have not really had to raise more money, and they're killing it. So when they sell in the next few years, I may get a check for $200,000 or $400,000. That's not a VC deal. That's a great angel deal. And what I did there was I invested in a situation where the valuation was low. They're already making revenue. I believed in the team. And I thought that, you know, I could at least 10X this. So I should be able to do that off of that deal. If they get a 30X, I would be shocked. That's probably a little bit outside of the reach of that deal based on the industry that it's in and all of the attributes and economic drivers that we know. So I really think about them differently, but it is good to your point that everybody goes into angel investing knowing what they are underwriting to.
Understood. I'd like to get into that criteria, but just because that would have been a beautiful segue, but I'm going to just one question before I get there. Okay. I know you mentioned like the deal flow groups, right? Some of them you're a part of, like Chicago Early. I sometimes have a bit of friction with the whole accredited versus unaccredited investor. You know, especially, I always make a joke of this too, is whether you're in the US or Canada, it's like, you know, banks will give you a $400,000 mortgage to buy a house. I live right across the casino that they just built in downtown River North in Chicago. I can literally walk in there tomorrow and spend like 50 grand, 100 grand. And I don't think anybody would tell me unless I'm missing something. But if you want to invest in, let's say, a private deal, officially and formally and legally, you have to be an accredited investor, which means your net worth has to be a certain number, which also means that then on paper, that is accessible to a few people, not everyone else. Just walk me through, like, as I make this comment, what observations come to mind? Does that upset you? How do you tackle this?
Well, I think historically it was there for good reason. But as information has become more accessible to people and as opportunities have become more accessible to people, I really think that the SEC should revise it and revise it downwards and also think about other ways to allow people to be accredited. So today there are a bunch of ways, but the two primary ways are one, your income and you've made over 200K in the last 2 years or 300K with a partner, or you have over $1 million of assets, net assets, excluding your primary residence. Mm-hmm. So if you are accredited by income or wealth, that's great. But what about people that go to business school? So, George, when you finish business school, I would argue that you've proven that you can analyze stuff. And if you can analyze stuff, you should be able to invest in whatever you want. And I do think at some point in our lifetimes, we're going to see that. It's just that they're such a slow-moving regulatory body that they don't know how to do it easily. And so today, there isn't a way for non-accredited people to invest, and that is through crowdfunding. The Jobs Act allows you to go on sites like WeFunder and invest, which is great, but I would argue there, just like in the casino, you know, there's not really safeguards. So we partner with WeFunder, and we have a group of angel investors who are both accredited and non-accredited. There's 540 people in Vitalize Angels, and we use our huge pipeline, and we pick the best two deals to show our investors every month. And I think of that as training wheels and a safety net. We have seen so much that we're leveraging our VC background and our VC network and our VC deal flow to get deals in front of our investors. And we help them with education and we help them with thinking through their strategies. And we help them to be able to invest at least $1,000 into the deals that they want. So
we'll start to see more access for non-accredited investors. It's just that today, primarily, it's still all accredited. It's a real shame. It's keeping a lot of people away from a seat at the table when I think we should be bringing more chairs out.
Yeah, I'd agree. I mean, especially when there are other asset classes that are, I mean, risk is very subjective to when you say something is risky. Well, on what basis and what criteria are you defining that as risky versus not? But like crypto as an example, again, no guardrails. I can open Robinhood tomorrow and invest my entire net worth into crypto if I wanted to. So I think that's just that's what's odd about it, is it's a specific asset class, not everything else, you know? Nonetheless, it's good to...
I agree. And I
like what you're doing with Vitalize Angels too. And I think that's a stepping stone to provide access. And I know that's a big piece of your, I would say, focus, but also your motivation is how do you bring more people into the angel investing scene, and probably reducing those misconceptions like the fact that you need a lot of money and that it's only accessible to a few people. Let's change, now we can segue, change hats, right? I know you're an investor, but you also deal with and you speak to many, many founders on a daily basis. You're probably flooded with inbound requests and, hey, look at us. Can you invest in us? Can we get on a call? A lot of founders are probably listening to this and they're wondering, what criteria do you look for in a founder? Let's start with just the qualitative. So we get on a call. What is an A+ call with George, the CEO of XYZ startup, look like?
I'm looking for a couple things. The first is a big and growing market. So if you're going after a niche, totally fine, but probably not a VC-backable business. So I would use your time accordingly. So I still see a lot of small markets. Make sure it's, you know, 3 or 5 billion or plus, or you shouldn't really be talking to VCs. Next is there some traction? And this is, I think, a sticking point with a lot of founders. And I see this all the time. I need help to start. So can I talk to you? And unfortunately, the answer is no, because it has become so inexpensive to start a business today versus what it ever has been in history that you should be able to get somewhere on your own. And what that does is it proves that you know how to go and seek resources. You know how to find information. You know how to synthesize a bunch of inputs and then actually execute to get an output. And it allows me to see how you're thinking. So those steps are actually really, 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 really important. There are other programs that can help with the start phase. So there are some grants out there. There are accelerator programs. There are even just co-working and incubator spaces like MHUB and 1871 in Chicago that really serve a need that I don't think VCs like me should be answering calls or trying to help people when they're at net zero. What I want to see is a founder that has their product live and they have customers using it. Like, that's really ideal for me. Like, that's the minimum for Vitalize Angels. And then the minimum that I need to see for our fund, which is a seed fund, is that they have a couple $100,000 of revenue. And so I really focus on the founders who can prove that execution.
Biggest pet peeve I can do to destroy this call.
The biggest pet peeve you could do?
Yeah.
Say, yeah. Gail, can I pick your brain?
Hey, Gail, can I pick your brain?
I hate that phrase. Everybody, please stop using that phrase. It makes me like think about a hair pick in a brain, and it's disturbing.
Yeah, I wonder what mine is. I'm trying to think. Maybe like it's a big hairy goal. I don't like that word. Yeah,
hairy?
But pick your brain. Yeah, no, because I think I saw it once on like there's like a VC panel. I'm like, out of every word you could have used, it's a bit of an odd one. But
yeah, pick your brain. And there's the old a bird in the hand is better than two in the bush. That's one in VC. Okay. Okay. But what are you going to do with the bird in your hand? Like, I don't want to think about that, you know?
That's my point. Like, out of all the analogies you could use, this is the one. You know, you're speaking in front of 400 people.
Some of these analogies. Anyway.
So pick your brain. I heard you, I think this is an important one, even though I might have to restate it, but you talk about interruptions a lot. Like a founder not giving you enough space to reply. Either maybe, and I think that could be because they're not confident enough, they're a bit insecure, they're nervous, so they overspeak. But something worth mentioning, right? To navigate the conversation carefully, right?
It's not something that bothers me. I probably am not going to invest in a founder, though.
Okay.
That's a great example of I am ingesting all kinds of information in a call with a founder. It's not just listening to their answers. It's how they say it. It's what the energy exchange is. How passionate are they about this business? Are they willing to say they don't know something? Are they really good and diligent about following up with things? Were they on time? All of this stuff is an input to help me understand how this founder thinks and how this founder operates. And believe me, everybody has bad days, and I'm not going to disqualify somebody, but if you're having a bad day, I would absolutely tell the investor, hey, I just had a really bad day and here's why, and so I'm a little off my game right now. And I'll give somebody maybe a second chance. But if I get interrupted a bunch, or if there's some negativity there, or you know, sometimes there's two founders on and one dismisses the other, I'm out. I don't want any part of that.
Yeah. I mean, it's a fine balance, right? Because I love how you're saying it. It's like, I'll give you grace because we're human and things come up. And that could have come up literally 10 minutes before this call. It's fine. But also, it is your first impression. I can't have 10, 30-minute intro calls with Gail either. So if this is your first call, much kind of like an interview, I mean, you do have to put your best foot forward.
Yeah, totally. And it helps me understand how you're able to sell. Because you're right now, you're selling investors. And it's not necessarily exactly like selling your product. However, it is similar enough that it gives me insight into, are you actually able to execute? Are you actually able to run me through a process and sell me in the end in a way that is going to work?
Has there been a creative, like the most creative approach that someone has tried to get into an intro with you versus just like a LinkedIn outreach or, you know, waiting outside your door with cookies? Not that I recommend that, but
No, I actually haven't seen too much. One VC that I know said that a founder sent the head of the fund some kind of very rare steering wheel from like an old Porsche or something, because that VC liked to collect old cars and they spent a little bit of money on it. So I've heard of some crazy stories, but by and large, either try to get an intro or send an actual good cold email. Most emails are really, really bad that I see, and I don't even read them because I can tell that it's a canned thing and it's super long. If you want to get an VC to read your stuff, make it personalized and make it two sentences and make sure all of your valid points about what traction you have are front and center. Because I don't want to read text even for 20 seconds. I get thousands of emails a day. So you're trying to fight with that. And I absolutely have invested in cold emails. It's rare because most of them are so bad.
You're going to get a bunch of really, really solid cold emails after this.
What I won't though, and here's why, because most people don't actually follow through. Mm. Like I've spoken to tons and tons of classes over time, and you know, all these students are like, oh, I really want to work, but I want to work for you. And I'm like, here's exactly what to do. And in my almost 12 years doing this, I've probably only gotten 3 to 5 really well-written emails from students, even after I've already told them. Like, you can go online and find all this stuff right now that I'm saying, but people don't spend the time on it because they want everything to be hand-fed to them. And that's never going to work in entrepreneurship. It is hard. I had a founder yesterday who was almost out of cash, get really upset about everything. It's like, and I told him, I was like, listen, entrepreneurship is, it's all BS all the time. Sure, there's highs and lows, but like you have to be able to handle a lot of BS. And if you can't, don't even get into this space.
Yeah. And also maybe be careful of airing your laundry on a 30-minute call. That's happened to me in the past with also a founder actually in Chicago. Same thing, like 30 minutes of just like venting. And listen, my wife's a clinical psychologist.
About what?
Everything. Everything you can possibly imagine.
Complaining about people?
Yeah, the ecosystem, people, the conferences, there's no startups, there's no capital, there's no, he spoke for like 28.30 seconds of the 30-minute call. And at the end, I was like, that's great catching up. And I hung up. Like, there's nothing for me to do. First of all, I left, and this was an intro call. So I left not even knowing anything about the business. It was actually sad. Like I had like a 30-second, that was a bummer for you. Because I could have maybe made an intro. I could have understood the business and tried to profile it somehow. Like we could have found one opportunity out of this 30 minutes. Definitely better than, you know, a 30 minute of just like venting. And again, okay, it's a bad day for sure. But maybe just say that up front and say, listen, I just want to vent. Okay. Then I'll have like my wife's psychology hat on and maybe I can hear you out. But yeah, I don't know. You got to be careful with that stuff.
This happens more than anybody would like. It's forced me over. I used to take every single request that came in and help every single person. And today I hardly help anybody. And I I feel kind of bad saying that, but I can't do it anymore because most people aren't actually prepared and aren't, I can't even help them. They're literally just going to waste both of our time. And that's the sad state of affairs. And so to stand out, really doing research and figuring out how to connect in a personal way with somebody that you really want to meet with. And I still do this. If there's somebody out there where I'm like, oh my God, I would love to meet with this person, I actually spend some time thinking about it instead of just shooting off some stupid canned email that it's never going to do anything. Like a lot of founders, a lot of people waste time trying to reach out to folks without really thinking through that connection.
Yeah, I wonder if part of it too is this, it's a bit of a metric game. You know, I hope that's not the case, but maybe for those canned emails that don't get any responses back, it's almost like if you're in a sales org and you're pressured to, let's say, hit like 100, you know, emails on Salesforce. And so you're just sending it out for the sake of just meeting that metric instead of sending 10 emails, but those 10 emails took a month of your effort to actually do the research, the diligence, because that's really what takes time. It's easy for me to reach out and be like, hey, Gail, I'm also in Chicago, I'd love to grab coffee. But you're like, who the hell is this guy? Versus going to an event takes time. Putting in the effort maybe to stay longer at the event. So after you speak, I'm like, hey, Gail, what's up? Just wanted to say great points. Heard you out. Third, if possible, investing. Let's say like having a formal connection between us where I'm backing up my words. And fourth, saying now I reach out with a subject line, be like, hey, I'm one of your very small investors. Big fan. Can I take you, you know, for a coffee? Just because I'd love to bolster my angel investing game. I guarantee you're probably going to say yes to that fourth piece.
Yeah.
But that took like 6 months.
Yeah, I'm in this business because I love people and I wish I could help everyone, but it's truly just, it's just tough. And that's why anybody that's interested in starting fund or starting a business, the networking piece is real. I mean, when I first started in 2012, 2013, I would go to every single event in Chicago. Every single founder event. And I probably did that for 3 or 4 years. And now I just kind of pick and choose. But I tell anybody that's starting in a new ecosystem, go meet everybody that you can at events, create relationships, and then keep going the ones that you really like. And that's really how the magic starts.
What about Chicago is appealing to you? Like out of anywhere you can, I'm assuming you can just live anywhere. That's just hypothetically, let's say you could, which you can, whether you want to or not. But
I'm in Nashville now, did I tell you? So I'm splitting. I'm staying in Chicago in the summer, what? But okay. Nashville is my winter.
You're snowboarding in Nashville? That's scary.
I turned 40. I had midlife crisis. I made this little cabin vision a reality. So yes, I'm a snowbird now.
Love it. I hear great things about Nashville. So yes. Makes sense.
Yes, it is. You know? And I love Chicago. I love Nashville. So I'm very, very, very fortunate. For
Are you there now?
Say it again.
Are you there now? Like, is this Nashville?
Yes, I am going to go to some events in downtown Nashville in about an hour.
Cool. How does it compare, by the way, like startup ecosystem, Nashville versus Chicago? Same?
It's similar. Really good people in both. I think Nashville, just by population, is a little bit smaller, but you know, similar size funds, lots of great founders in both, really kind of open networking at events, which is nice, very welcoming atmosphere in both places. So there's not too much difference except for maybe size.
Size of like volume market, I guess.
Size of number of founders, number of VCs, and then in Nashville, it really there's a lot of healthcare here and a lot of entertainment, music. In Chicago, I think we're a little bit more finance and some of your standard enterprise SaaS.
Got it. What I guess looking forward to 2024, what excites you about Chicago and now Nashville, let's say the Midwest startup ecosystem, the investing ecosystem, what excites you and what makes you a little bit more uneasy in terms of challenges?
I think we're going to continue to see capital be tough for founders to get, which means that we as investors have to really, really, really work hard to help them. That's just going to be a challenge. The M&A markets haven't come back. My guess is that they're going to come back next year and we should see an upswing in 25. On the positive side, I think right now, those who are starting companies on average have more experience than I've seen in a long time. They have more passion than I've seen in a long time. And I think the reason that is because there aren't a lot of just kind of fair weather entrepreneurs out there being like, oh, I guess I'm going to do this because the economy is so good and I want to do the next AI 4X business. It's really people who are like, I have wanted to do this for a long time. now is the right time. I'm going to take advantage of this. I'm going to downsize my lifestyle and just go for it. And those fearless founders have, I think, a really cool opportunity right now to make big businesses.
Yeah, that's a great point. Why WorkTech? I forgot to ask you this, but speaking of building great businesses, like, why that specific niche? Was that always a thing for you?
Kind of. I personally am kind of a process geek nerd. I just see things in operations and process. And so business to business to me makes a lot of sense. Consumers, way more fun. Don't get me wrong. And there are very few consumer businesses that go nutty. And if you're in one, awesome. However, business to me makes a lot of sense. And I've always been interested in kind of organizational development and learning and development and helping people. So the HR side of the house is a historical interest of mine. And the two companies I started, one was in learning and development and one was in hiring recruiting. So I have a background in it personally. Mm. When I look at the 180 to 200 companies that I've done historically, a lot of them would fit into WorkTech, which we define very broadly as B2B software that dramatically improves work outcomes. So it's a lot of general B2B SaaS. We just want to make sure that they're really big ideas and then either the employers, the employees, ideally both, have a much better experience and outcome because of the new tech solution that we're investing in.
Mm, that makes a lot of sense. So back, it kind of ties into the intro where we were talking about investing in what you love, mm-hmm. maybe what you have experience in, or also what you have a strategic pull into.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And then from the consumer side, you and I and everybody listening, we all use this stuff. So it's not just productivity. That's maybe a slice of what we do. But, you know, we invested in Stylo, which is a customer support platform, which is super cool. And almost every company everywhere has a really terrible customer service system. And yeah. I, as an end customer, would love to see that become better. So that kind of stuff is very relevant and tied in all over the place in WorkTech.
Has there been one golden goose, like one startup that's done really, really well? That
for my portfolio or just in general?
In general. Could be yours, Irish, whatever.
Well, my three biggest companies historically out of both portfolios would be Chime, TradingView, and Placer.
Nice. So. TradingView is big. I didn't know, aren't they Chicago based?
They went through Chicago Techstars.
They did, right? Yeah. I mean, I used them a lot because I have a finance undergrad.
Yeah.
So I used them a lot, even early on. Like, they've been around for quite some time.
But yeah, Irish Angels invested in 2013.
Wild.
Yeah.
That's awesome. Closing thoughts. I have one kind of a rapid fire and then maybe it's just lessons learned. Do you enjoy being more of an investor than a founder or a founder investor?
As somebody that runs a small fund, I have to think like a founder because we don't have a huge budget. We need to keep our team small and there has to be magic there. So that's just like a startup team. And then on the investment side, I think of that as our offering. So that's our product or service. Just like, you know, founder might be building a tech company. We have a people-based product offering and it is surrounding founders and investors. So it's, I think, very similar to being a founder. It's just that the thing that we're building is very different than what your typical founder that we think of in the tech world is doing.
Mm. And then not to go into the last piece as an investment advice, but more so, I have a little bit of disposable income. I'm interested after this conversation to do something with it. What's the first thing you would do? If specifically, let me specify, if you're looking to be an angel investor and just start with one company, but you're not, like you and I are very involved in the startup ecosystem by virtue of what we do. Let's say you're not, you have no connectivity. What's the first thing you would do if I have $5,000 and I want to invest in a company? What's the first thing Gail would do?
Well, I would ask first if we were having a conversation, why is the startup world? Because everybody, assuming that they have this, which I know it's lucky that we all do, cash savings for problems, then we want stock market. And then from there, it's something to hedge. So it could be real estate holdings. It could be some kind of credit. It could be VC or angel or some combination of that. And there's other stuff that's out there too. Let's say you want to do angel. I would ask why. And if you tell me, okay, well, I would just really, really, really love to learn about new companies. And that stuff's super exciting. And so I want to be an investor because I want to be close to it. This is an answer that I get a lot. All right, great. Go and do research on a bunch of groups and find one. So Gangels is free. We are very inexpensive at Vitalize Angels. We have a free membership for students. If you're a grad student, you can join for free. And then there's other ones like Josephine Collective in Chicago is very inexpensive. That's for women that want to get started in kind of a safe environment. Chicago Early, also very inexpensive, that just does Chicago deals run by Jeff and Brian. And then all over the country, you've got other stuff. So the Council by Amber Illig is also very good and inexpensive, and the prices kind of go up from there. So you can find anything. But do research on angel groups that you feel drawn to and reach out to whoever runs them or the membership coordinator and say, hey, can I have a call? And then do your research online, have the call, and see which one feels right. And then see if you can sit in on a meeting and find one and join it. And then once you're in there, part of what you're looking for is already done. You're around the founders, you're in the room, you have the excitement. And the next step is back to what we talked about. How much money do you want to deploy in the space? And how many deals do you want to do a year? Most people should do at least 3 deals a year, minimum 2. So if you're not accredited, some people can only do 2,200 max per the SEC. That's kind of the maximum, the smallest maximum level. So in that case, you would be doing 2 deals a year, 1 at $1,000 each, and that's great. But if to the extent you can do 3 or 4 or 5 deals per year, that's great. So now you've got your strategy of, I know I'm doing X number of deals per year at about X dollars each. And then you've got your deal flow and you've got your strategy. And you want to just start writing your check. And the first one could be a little scary because you're like, I don't know. I like it, but I'm scared. You just have to write the check. You just have to do it. And then remember, it's lit on fire. It's gone. You just don't think about it anymore. But you're really going to pay attention now. The company, not to really the money. You're going to pay attention to the company and the excitement of, okay, wow, this founder's doing really good things. Or, oh no, this founder's in trouble. And the learning that happens after you have set the wire and after you have signed the check is very different than if you're sitting in a classroom or if you're a member of the angel group and you're just watching everyone. So I really encourage you, if you do have the income to invest and you're interested in it, you got to just write your first check. And once you do, then it becomes a lot easier.
Love it. Gail Wilkinson, thank you. This was straight fire. The last piece could be something special. I feel like I like it. A lot of sound bites. Thanks again for being here. I really appreciate it. You're a close friend. I regard you as a close friend in the Chicago and Nashville now.
Yeah.
Ecosystems. Come on down, and just come on down. And kudos to all the work you do. I want to say it before I stop recording.
Thank you. Well, you as well. Really appreciate you bringing me on today. And thanks everybody for listening.
If you found this podcast useful, make sure to share it out with your community. And if you haven't already done so, subscribe to the podcast. I'll see you next time.